welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Coveting Idina Menzel's wardrobe and uncut gems.
Not that, actually.
Oddly specific, Peter.
Maybe Adam Sandler's sunglasses.
Okay.
I think I could pull those off.
Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you all a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you are done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. I am delighted to have Joe Bob Briggs on board as a biweekly columnist. And special features like A Year Without Streaming are on the site from writers like Chris Moody at Vice. We'll also have the musings of yours truly, and we'll have some great critical voices like Outlaw Vern and Jacob Knight. We are paying good people good money for the content you are enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now, and we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access, just $2 a month or $20 for the whole year. That is less than most Patreons, which means it's pretty cheap. So, you know, just pitch in, help us out. You know, you sign up, you get a little something, you have a good time. We all hang out here. We do the podcast. Get to keep doing the podcast. Pretty excited. All right. On to the show. First up in controversies and non-troversies, Where the Men At? That's right. Male moviegoers are not showing up for Greta Gerwig's Little Women, and the commentariat is none too pleased. The great Janet Maslin, who I like a lot, actually. I don't want this to feel like criticism of her. I think she is fantastic. But she has noted that, quote, There is, quote, an act of hostility about Little Women from men I know, love, and respect, end quote. And Monica Hess in the Washington Post lamented the plight of the Little Women men who, quote, feel slightly nervous about going to see the movie without a female chaperone, end quote. Ironically, despite being the resident chauvinist reactionary on Across the Movie Aisle, I am the only person here who has seen it, which leads me to wonder, Alyssa, why do you hate women so much?
The answer is I don't hate women. The patriarchy has denied me the opportunity to see Little Women because you two made me go see Uncut Gems.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Uncut Gems is good, and
True.
Little Women is mediocre. So
we'll get to that in a little bit.
But no, seriously, it is fascinating to me that men who ostensibly sort of care about cinema and seeing the breadth of human experience through cinema would be anxious about seeing Little Women, considering that women are assumed to be interested in movies mostly starring men in men's perspectives all of the time. And it strikes me as just sort of obviously silly and maybe even a little cowardly that men would be like anxious about seeing Little Women in some way, not least because if you are especially a younger man out there and want to understand a lot of heterosexual American women, having read Little Women is kind of a useful urtext for talking to girls. I mean, it's one of those books that a lot of women in America read at a formative stage in their lives. It is arguably has become sort of a story form that is repurposed over and over again. Like, why would you be anxious about seeing it or assume that it's not for you? Not least because Little Women, yes, is about the four March sisters, but it is also almost as importantly about Lori Lawrence, sort of the boy next door who ends up playing an important role in all of their lives. And it becomes this dialogue about, you know, what kind of man do you want to be? That's an important part of the core story. And so the idea that there's some anxiety about it is just sort of sad to me. It's like a little bit pathetic.
This is, all right, so first off, the most interesting part of the new film is watching Timothée Chalamet work his way through the March sisters over the decade or so that this story takes place. It's the most likable I've ever seen him, frankly. But I also think that this is a total... I think that this is a nonsense framing That there's some sort of anxiousness or anxiety about going to see the movie.
And of course, let's be honest, all of these things, like quantifying that sort of anxiety is basically impossible.
There were at least four tweets.
The real question here is interest, right? I mean, Peter, is this you have not seen it either, and you have access to many movie theaters here in the Washington D.C. area,
this
including press screenings, and yet you have not rushed out to go see this. Would you say this is because you're anxious about going to see it, or you're just not that interested?
I'm very interested in seeing it. I'm not anxious about seeing it. I have had to prioritize other films because we have this movie podcast, and I've got to go see things
like
Uncut Gems.
So the patriarchy is keeping you down as well.
No, not the patriarchy.
A combination of the patriarchy and capitalism, let's be clear.
The patriarchy, Sonny Bunch.
I am the patriarchy. I am representative of it.
So I think Greta Gerwig is a great director, and I'm really excited to see this movie. I just have not had time. It's been a particularly busy and hectic holiday season for me. But I want to sort of try and twist this conversation just a little bit and ask, isn't a film like Little Women, and that is, as you said, Alyssa, the book, the previous movies, this story really does appeal to young American women. It's kind of an urtext for them. Isn't a movie like this in some ways an attempt to create a female space? And in doing so, doesn't that to some extent, it's not like it prohibits men or it says no men allowed. It's not like Calvin and Hobbes putting up, a gross get rid of slimy girls sign. It is, on the other hand, saying we have a target audience. That audience is women, and girls who liked this book and who liked this story and who are particularly fond of it. And isn't there always, in fact, something a little bit odd and uncomfortable about men invading female spaces? I will point in particular to The Wing, which is a female-led, it started as a female-only club for women, and so you can kind of go there and work, right?
Yeah.
Except, you're right, it's basically a WeWork, except there's also a kind of networking for, upscale
WeWork
professionals.
Meets
Soho
House, basically.
Right, for female professionals, and they have adjusted their membership policy recently so that technically men are allowed, at least in some states, maybe in all of them. But of course, the idea is still that it's for women. And women and men have started to come into these spaces in small numbers. And there are stories about women being uncomfortable because that was supposed to be their space. And so I guess the question I have, or sort of the thing that I wonder is, isn't there a place for female-only spaces sometimes at the movies?
Yeah, but at the same time, I think that there is a tendency to both create these female spaces or permit the creation of these female spaces and then to be sort of critically condescending about them or to assume that because things are happening in those female spaces that there's no need to be interested in them, right? Mm. And, I go to movies a lot of the time, even though they don't necessarily represent my particular experience, because I'm interested in human beings, right? I mean, I have nothing in common with Howard Ratner, the Diamond District jeweler and gambling addict who is the main character of Uncut Gems, the movie we're about to watch. The only thing we have in common is that we're both Jewish. But the point is, I go to the movies in part because I both am interested in seeing my experience reflected on screen, but even though that is not something that is often particularly available to me, I'm interested in people who are not like me, right? I wouldn't necessarily go to, if there was like one of the all-black sororities was having a Black Panther screening, I wouldn't see it as my place to go into that particular screening of the movie. Just as if there was an all-female Little Women screening, it might be inappropriate for men to try to crash it. But that doesn't mean that I'm not interested in Black Panther or in the cultural attachment to Black Panther by people who aren't like me. And so I think that it's one thing to say, yeah, this movie is geared towards women for whom it's been this kind of urtext. But if you're interested in women, shouldn't you be interested in this, more than 100-year-old cultural artifact that has been revitalized and reinterpreted over and over again?
I do think it just comes down to it is a commitment to go to the movie theater, and what one thing that Greta Gerwig and the studio Sony has done very well is target that audience. And look, in many ways, I would argue that the numbers here, Scott Mendelson had the first weekend numbers. Little Women played 66% female and 56% over 25. So it's basically a movie that is targeted squarely at one quadrant of the box office.
At the
older
least
women.
Served
at
quadrant.
At the least served.
Of the
at,
box
the, at the least served in. And,
and that's good.
In theory, hardest to get out quadrant of the box office. The older woman demographic, right? Now, the fact that this movie is a box office success, I think we can say that it is doing very well at the box mm-hmm. office, shows that they have done a good job of targeting that audience and giving them something they like. And a friend of ours, Zach Stentz, a screenwriter, mm-hmm. made a very good point a couple months ago that if you look at some of the mid-budget movies that have done very well over the last year or two, what they are targeted at are specific audiences. So I believe the example he was using was Crazy Rich Asians yeah. And yep. maybe something else. But you know that movie did a very good job of turning out Asian American audiences. Tyler Perry has built an entire studio network, yeah. An entire studio essentially based on serving African American audiences. You know, look at Ford v Ferrari, which passed $100 million domestic this weekend, or maybe a couple weekends ago, but it passed $100 million at the box office, and it did that by turning out older men. Again, an underserved demographic, just because old people don't go to the movies anymore. So, I mean, look, I would only semi-puckishly argue that the fact that this movie is overperforming with women and is underperforming with men is actually by design and means that the studio has done a good job of not only making it, but marketing it.
Look, and I think nobody has to go see Little Women. Nobody has to see any movie. But to treat the movie as if it's, you know, somehow twee because it's about women, because it's this remake, because it, you know, because it's aimed at women in the first place, which I think becomes this kind of weird circular logic. You know, men, I love you. I'm married to one of you. But you're not inherently more interesting than women. The only reason that your experiences are treated as the default is because they've been that way for so long, and women to survive have been forced to adapt and figure out what's going on. But if you care about women and what's going on in their brains, it's worth engaging with our perspectives, with our stories. And hey, you know, it might even help you meet someone or strike up a conversation at the bar. I'm not saying that this is like about to become a dating advice podcast, but come on. You don't have to go see it if you're not interested, but it's worth interrogating that contempt.
I mentioned Calvin and Hobbes earlier and Calvin's club with his pet tiger, his pet stuffed tiger, Gross, Get Rid of Slimy Girls. And it's like, it's a really kind of delightful parody of young adolescent male obsession with women and the way, as well as like, they're sort of like, where they pretend to be grossed out and to sort of, to kind of despise them and think that they're superior. And the point that the Gross comic strips always make is that in fact, it's a way of for Calvin to process the fact that he's really quite attracted to Susie Durkins, who is a much more responsible and adult person who has like figured out how to just behave socially. And in fact, it's a kind of adolescent male tendency to try to exclude women as a way of, in some ways, getting their attention. And there's a fair amount of that in some of the male-female gender discourse about movies, you know, on the internet. Calvin and Hobbes explains a lot about our current world.
It is the key to modernity. All right, guys, what do we think? Is it a controversy that men aren't lining up to see Little Women, or a non-controversy? Alyssa?
It's ultimately kind of a non-controversy.
Non-controversy,
that's right. No men have to go see this movie. Next up, this week in theaters is a movie that's decidedly more masculine. Uncut Gems is about Howard Ratner, a guy who can't stop, won't stop, seriously cannot stop. He cannot stop being a self-destructive idiot. Played with immaculate smarm and charm by Adam Sandler, Ratner is a portrait of compulsion, a gambler addicted to the rush of the bets. To paraphrase another manly man and another film about manly men, for Howard, the action is the juice. Set in 2012, the film follows Howard's efforts to climb out of gambling debt by winning big and failing a big win by selling a beautiful opal he has smuggled out of Africa. I have to say, this movie from the Safdie brothers is a total masterpiece of tension theater. It is a movie that kind of assaults the audience in an almost physical way. I will be honest with you guys. I nearly had a panic attack on three different occasions while watching this. Once
only three.
Once was in the diamond store where Kevin Garnett is locked in a very small space, and Adam Sandler kind of keeps running back and forth trying to get him out of this little locked booth. The other was at a school.
It's
the
a
scene
dual
at the
entry
play.
Security door.
Yeah,
system.
he's like locked. Kevin Garnett, who is like 7'2" or whatever, is locked in a space that's about 7'5", and he's trying to get
with
to get
several
out of it.
Other people.
Yeah,
it might be
it's very. It's designed to make the claustrophobic amongst us like tight in the chest. The other instances was the scene in the school play where Sandler sees his mob backed bookies trying to chase him down and get their money from him while he's trying to enjoy his daughter's performance, and it combines all parents' worst nightmares, which is being at a school performance of any sort.
And one thing I thought was great about that scene is it's clear that the daughter's not a very good actor, and neither is anyone else in the play.
Sure, they don't do
the thing where it's like, actually, let's cast a bunch of really talented child actors and make this a reasonably compelling production.
And then again at the end, as we watch a basketball game that happened, you know, 7 years ago or whatever, play out in real time, more or less, on the screen, and we hope that Ratner is able to get his make his bets and win the money and get himself out of debt. Peter, you came out of the screening last night raving. You were sending text messages. You were like, this is why I go to the movies.
It is.
Why did you love it so much?
So this is a story about a character and a place and the ways that a particular person and their habits kind of drive them to the brink. And it's a great character study, but it really felt to me like early Scorsese. And I kept thinking about Mean Streets as I was watching this, because Mean Streets is another movie about sort of the scuzzy, like New York characters, of the 1970s. And this is a movie about kind of scuzzy, quasi-criminal characters of the late 2010s in New York, and the way it captures a particular place, the Diamond District, but also some of the outer boroughs and other parts of New York, and that sort of realistic feel to it, without feeling like it's just sort of here's a documentary kind of approach to things. I was really, really taken not only by all the performances, but also all of the kind of other technical elements, in particular Darius Kanji's cinematography. This is just a masterclass in sheer kind of high wire craft filmmaking. And you talked about this being a masterpiece of anxiety movie making. Look at the way that Kanji moves the camera, not just the shots that he picks and the way he frames things, but the way he is constantly just sort of kind of swinging it around, moving it in ways that feel erratic, feel like they're sort of jumpy, like there's just always a lot going on and another thing happening and another, and yet it's also incredibly clear. And it's not Michael Bay kind
it's
of let's
shaky
put this into
cinema.
Into a yeah. blender. There's a level of incredible clarity that gets you in the kind of into the headspace of Adam Sandler's character, where he is always just thinking a million miles a minute and thinking in ways that are actually quite clear to some extent, but also not always making, in fact, very rarely making good judgment calls. And so I loved it as a kind of character study, as a study of place, and just as an impeccable piece of filmmaking craft.
So this is the kind of movie that I would have expected to hate, flames on the side of my face, right? I mean, we talked last week about how stressful I found watching Punch Drunk Love, which has this sort of really overwhelming score, this sort of profound awkwardness and sense of just constant humiliation to it. And I don't love Sandler as a performer. I mean, I can recognize what he's really good at without finding that particularly compelling, but I love this movie. And I think that it struck me so hard in part because we're coming off this year where there's been a lot of discussion about sort of what cinema is, what film is. And this movie is a really good example of what the movies can do that no other form can do. It's visually really audacious. I mean, it has these sort of long swoops into and out of the opal in question that are sort of hallucinogenic and moody. And
which it then matches with these overhead shots. Sorry to interrupt, but it's just like there's so much visual matching and patterning in this film that's really subtle, right? It's not like sort of painterly. Mm.
But it does something. I mean, it uses incredibly powerful visuals to take you someplace that it would be difficult to describe in words, that would be less sort of overwhelming and compelling on a smaller screen. It uses that in conjunction with a powerful, intrusive score to enhance that feeling. And it uses images and sound combined with characters and narrative over 2 hours and 12 minutes, I think it is, to, you know, take on a whole bunch of themes and ideas and to do it in a way that sort of makes a series of arguments that are not conventional sort of political arguments or prose arguments. But I mean, there are these recurring conversations about, you know, why Jews are so obsessed with basketball, which is a way of literalizing the movie's exploration of the relationship between Jewish people and Black culture, which is a complicated, longstanding, sometimes appropriative relationship that gets sort of played out in some detail here in the relationship between Howard, his fixer, played by Lakeith Stanfield, and Garnett, who makes off with this opal and sort of throws Howard's life into chaos. You know, there is this long arc device about the ethics of what Howard's doing, buying this opal from Ethiopia. The opening scene is actually set at an opal mine in Ethiopia. Yeah. And I watched it and sort of thought, oh God, we're never going to return to this again. It's going to feel really gross and exploitative. And no, actually, we do return to it towards the end of the movie when Kevin Garnett asks Howard about the ethics of, you know, paying $100,000 for something you thought was worth $1 million. Mm-hmm. And Howard makes the sort of typical, oh, well, it's more than they'd make in 50 years. And Garnett says to him, well, $1 million is still more. And then there's this argument about sort of morality and chaos and whether you can actually harness chaos by immoral means. The movie ends with Howard having won this bet and then getting shot in the face and killed.
Immediately.
Yeah. Yes.
We should probably have spoiler warning.
This show is a perpetual spoiler warning on it.
And so, I mean, to me, I loved it. I loved it unexpectedly, and I loved it both for itself and because it just felt like something, you know, I would like to sit down a bunch of Marvel fans in front of this movie and say, like, this is what Martin Scorsese means when he talks about the Marvel movies not being cinema. Mm-hmm. Like, this
Scorsese was a producer on this.
Yes.
It's pretty. I mean, you can clearly see some of his influence, I think.
But I just think that combination of qualities is not something you see in blockbusters in quite the same way.
So to this point, I do think it is interesting to note that the cinema score on this film is a C+.
Yeah.
So this is a movie that had expectedly on A24, the studio's part, large opening. It opened in limited release to, I think, something like $107,000 a screen, which was a record for A24. And then when it went wide, it opened over 5 days, something like $25 million or something like that, $25 million, which, again, was another record for A24 over that period of time. And it is, I would say, one of their... It is a film that is, I think, confounding to a lot of mainstream audiences. This is not a movie that you put in 2,500 screens necessarily. And they did, and there was some pushback on that from audiences. Here's my question. This was a long way of getting to the question. You say we should sit down the Marvel audiences and have them watch this. What happens when they don't like it and they decide that all they want is more Marvel, where Captain America isn't getting shot in the face after he,
I mean, they functionally made
the Red Skull.
They functionally made that decision already, so at least they would have seen Uncut Gems.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, to go back to our sort of Little Women conversation, another thing that's interesting about this movie is just how good and how, to a certain extent, developed the two female characters in the movie are, despite like all of the chaos swirling. It's a very male movie, but it's also a movie that's kind of divided between two women, one of whom sees Howard clearly and is getting away from him as fast as she possibly can, and one who sort of shares his desire not to see the world as it really is. And there's a moment sort of halfway through, and that's part of the school play sequence, where Idina Menzel's character, Dinah, Howard's wife, who's planning on leaving him, gets a text that he's locked in the trunk of this car and like runs across the parking lot to see him.
The text says, I locked my keys in the car.
He is,
what
in fact,
she doesn't know is that he's locked in there naked after a relative who he owes a ton of money.
I think his brother-in-law.
His brother-in-law.
Yeah, has like beaten him up, stripped him naked, and locked him in his own car.
But she does this fabulous like running in Louboutins trot across the parking lot that is so funny and just like a wonderful bit of physical humor And I think I was the only person in the theater who laughed at it.
I think there was a little bit of kind of chuckling, but you definitely thought it was you. It struck you, I think, more than
you
other people in the theater.
Would you say you guffawed?
Yeah.
I wasn't in the theater with you guys. I saw this before you did.
I probably giggled. Okay. I would say I wouldn't guffaw, okay. But it's like it's a movie that, for all its shagginess, is just very precise in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It allows it does a neat trick of maintaining a kind of ironic, humorous distance from its characters and allowing them to be ridiculous while not just making them cartoons or clowns or idiots. Yeah. It is actually quite humane and empathetic towards even its kind of more monstrous characters. It shows them out to be people about as bad as they are. And I guess this is what this is the thing that made me love this movie even more. You know, I talked about the acting and the craft and all the story and the way it's shot, all that stuff. What sort of hit me the most was this movie has a real moral center, and it starts with the Diamond Mind, ends with the Sandler character's death, and the
and his brother-in-law's death. Right? I mean, this is not. You know, and there's a version of this movie where his brother-in-law lives, and there's something sort of haunting about that too. But
it's a movie about fate and about the consequences of your actions, and it forces its characters. It says, you know, at some you can get away with a lot, but at some point, if you take on all of this risk, it is going to karma. You know, the karma that starts when you're buying this diamond that when we see it at the mine at the beginning,
opal.
We see when you, the opal, sorry. When you see the opal at the beginning, we see the opal mine. We see that people there are really quite harmed, right? It's abusive to the, you know, exploitative.
It opens specifically with a miner being maimed.
Yeah. Yeah. And that it all comes back to haunt you. It all, right? You eventually pay for it. And I thought a lot about Joker, which is another movie deeply indebted to Martin Scorsese. And one of the reasons I really didn't like Joker was because I thought it had no moral center. It was a well-crafted film, you know, a kind of very stylistic film, but it wasn't one that really had a kind of a meaningful moral idea about the universe.
Well, I think Joker is more a movie about chaos and uncertainty than
Uncut
this.
Gems is a movie about chaos.
No. Uncut Gems is a movie about compulsion and addiction and messing with forces you cannot understand. I mean, this is why the brother is killed at the end. It's because he has enlisted people he does not understand to do his work for him.
Right.
And when he crosses
also,
them, he loses control.
I think that's fair,
but
there's still a lot
of chaos. And he's also sort of outsourcing violence, right? I mean, as part of that moral arc, the person who kills Howard and his brother, Arno, I think that's right, is one of Arno's thugs who has been sort of sent around and who has just been sort of, by both men, sort of pushed beyond his endurance, right? I mean, he's been asked to be forgiving with Howard for probably far longer than he actually should have been,
given
the magnitude of Howard's debts. He is, you know, constantly kind of scammed and asked to be fed this, he's asked to swallow this pack of lies by Howard. And he's not a major character. He's not someone who is developed, but he is ultimately the agent of retribution at the end of the movie, right? And it's an argument to a certain extent. It's not so perfectly parallel as to have, like, you know, an Ethiopian opal miner show up in New York and exact revenge on Howard. But it's like the people who you mistreat and ignore and treat as non-people can ultimately be the author of your fate.
Okay, so I think I know the answer to this, but just in case we want to be sure. What do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Uncut Gems?
Yeah, but maybe have a drink because it's real stressful.
Not just thumbs up. It's one of my two favorite movies of the year.
Yeah, it's my third favorite movie of the year, and I have a feeling it will only grow in retrospect. That brings us to assigned viewing. Up this week is Spectre, or more specifically, the first scene of Spectre, and then kind of the rest of it. Peter, why are we watching Sam Mendes's Bond movie?
We are watching Spectre in preparation for 1917. Like 1917, Spectre was directed by Sam Mendes. 1917 is an entire movie that is a single shot. Obviously, it's not actually a whole a single shot, but it has been built to look as if it's a single shot. And Spectre starts with an absolutely incredible long take in which James Bond walks through and then eventually ends up kind of shooting his way and exploding his way through a Day of the Dead festival in Mexico. And it's I don't love this movie, but I love this opening shot. And the movie is, its existence is justified in some ways by the opening shot, as mediocre and frustrating as I found the rest of the film.
Well, the story behind that shot is actually kind of interesting.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the studio came to Mendes and was like, we need like some tax credits or something. Will you shoot a scene in Mexico so we can put it in the film?
Yeah.
And he was like, well, I'll do it if I can do like whatever ridiculous thing I want to do. And he built this shot slash scene out of that.
It was basically, my understanding is the movie was going way over budget. It was like a $200, $250 million budgeted film. And it was hitting the $330 mark. And the studio was like, well, if we shoot a scene that highlights like special locations and events in Mexico City, they're going to give us something like $15 or $20 million.
Yeah.
And this was what came out of it. And it is, I mean, you know,
I
think film subsidies are bad. On the other hand,
I remember,
like, but in this case, rent seeking works.
Yeah. I do remember when this happened, I was like, God, I feel like that shot must have cost more than the $15 million in subsidies they got. Like, it's a really intricate and well done.
And it's a couple of shots. It's not all one shot. Yeah. It is like 1917 strung together to look as if it is one shot.
Alyssa, how do you what do you like most about this whole sequence?
I think part of what is interesting about it is I tend to find tracking shots like a little bit overrated. I think they've become one of those things that are a signifier that this is serious work in a way that is not always the case, but it makes you feel not so much that you're in a Bond movie, but it makes you feel like the parade and the holiday is supposed to feel, right? I mean, it gives you this sense that, you know, it's a Day of the Dead parade. There are these huge floats going by, everyone in, you know, sort of masks and disguise. And the tracking shot, it's not just that it's a tracking shot, right? It sort of floats and dips and it makes you feel strange. It's not necessarily just sort of a pure action thing. It's not just that it's cool. It makes you feel a little dislocated and uncomfortable. And on a holiday that is sort of about the upending of the natural order, the idea that the dead have awoken and are walking the streets of Mexico City, it really achieves that thematically in a way that is interesting. And it's also just, it's interested in the surroundings and in, you know, I mean, the Mexican government got its money's worth as far as I'm concerned. I definitely sort of noted to myself, okay, maybe we should find a way to visit Mexico City while I was watching
it. It's a sequence that shows you in great detail. It helps you understand the layout of the physical space.
Yep.
And that's what the great tracking shots, I mean, if you think of the one that everybody thinks of in Goodfellas, right? Mm. It's
entering the Copacabana through the back door.
What that shows you is a whole world, is how that space is laid out. And because there's no cuts, there's no edits, right? You're seeing it in that case basically from the perspective of Ray Liotta's character, but in this
more
case,
more specifically, Ray Liotta's girlfriend's character.
In Spectre, it's not from James Bond's perspective, but what it does is it moves around him so that you are, in some sense, seeing what he's seeing, and you are starting to see the world through James Bond's eyes, and seeing how he can be looking around at this kind of crazy parade and this incredibly elaborate hotel and all these beautiful people. And what's he seeing? He's seeing a woman in a dress. He's seeing an escape out a window. He's moving with intention, and you're starting to, it allows you to start thinking like James Bond thinks.
Yeah.
And so so it's not just there to show off. It is also there to show off, but it's not just about sort of technical sophistication. It's about helping you understand how the character interacts with a complex physical world.
Well, and one of the things that's very interesting about it is that Bond's character is always moving in the opposite direction of the current of traffic. And you see both, again, sort of how he sees the world as Peter sees it, but also how he sort of disappears into the world despite being very different from it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he, you know, he blends in, he picks up a girl, and if you thought about it at all, why is this person following another person in the opposite direction of the parade, right? He ought to be noticeable. He ought to stand out. And what the camera shows us, and again, one of the things that's sort of disorienting about it, is how he's simultaneously visible to us and invisible to everyone else. It sort of puts us in his head, on his side, and makes that feel unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I'm asking a question. I should know the answer to this. But is the shot in Uncut Gems when they are in the Diamond office and Kevin Garnett is locked in the glass, you know, little security lobby? Mm-hmm. Is that a single shot where Adam Sandler's going back and forth, getting like the shavings, putting it in the thing? Because I'm pretty sure it was.
So there's the part where he is going to get the shavings and the little file.
Yeah.
There is at least one extended bit there, but yeah. I believe it also cuts into Kevin Garnett.
We get
close-ups of him that
and
are
And there's also a cut to like the guy in the office who's coming out with the toolbox and
right.
things.
Well, I thought that was also part of the shot. Anyway, but like the extended shots there, and maybe it's not one continuous shot, but it is a series of longer shots between cuts, there's a goal there, which is to make you incredibly like nervous, to make you feel the tension, or the long tracking shot that's at the beginning of Boogie Nights that introduces you not only to every character who is in the movie, but also the whole milieu of that like kind of early 70s porn scene. There are long tracking shots that are kind of a wank, as you say, Alyssa, mm-hmm. as like they are just like, okay, I'm showing off. This is you know, a serious movie. Look at me do my serious movie director things.
Yeah.
But when they are done well, they are one of the most effective tools in the arsenal of a director, just in terms of delivering information visually and giving people a sense of the
totality.
Space.
Yeah.
I think we should also not just credit the director here, though, but the cinematographers. And on Uncut Gems is shot by Darius Kanji, who is one of the great cinematographers. He's shot, among other things, he shot Seven, City of Lost Children, Alien Resurrection. He worked with Genet a bunch. He's a French-Iranian photographer. And what's remarkable to me about the way he works in Uncut Gems is how different that work is from his much more painterly, kind of, you know, deeply, richly lit stuff that he was doing in the 90s and early aughts. And he's adopted a very harsh, gritty style for Uncut Gems. And yet you still see just the kind of masterful way that he plays with light and moves characters with, you know, in and out of shadows, the ways that he chooses to put them in very harsh light at times.
Mm.
Actually, I would bring this back to Spectre. Because the rest of Spectre, I think, is occasionally kind of good looking and beautiful. It's not without its kind of its visual charms. But what makes it a much worse movie overall than Skyfall is that Sam Mendes is not working with Roger Deakins. And Roger Deakins, probably the greatest cinematographer of the last 30 or 40 years, certainly one of them, shot Skyfall. And he also shot 1917, which I haven't seen yet, but we're going to talk about next week. And Roger Deakins makes Skyfall a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
I actually would like a kind of neat or a weird way to think about Skyfall that is that it, like, play back the scenes in your head just like on the page without the way that they look. The particular way that they look is what makes them good. The mm-hmm. dialogue isn't all that great. The story is just fine. Daniel Craig is good, so, quite good as James Bond,
so
as always.
So it's a James Bond movie.
But it's a James Bond movie with Roger Deakins photography.
Right. It looks better.
Which not just makes it look better, makes it a great movie. And to me, Skyfall is not a Sam Mendes film. It's a Roger Deakins film, and he's the one who made it great.
Mm.
I think it's worth noting that the Spectre director of photography is Hoyt Van Hoytema, though. So, I mean, it's not like there's a no-name cinematographer on that movie.
No, that's true. I mean, again, it looks good, but I think
also
the movie just doesn't come together.
Dunkirk, one of the
and Interstellar
best looking movie films.
Yeah. Ad Astra, which looked good, even if I didn't necessarily like it.
He's very good. And again, the opening shot of Spectre is, of course, you want to credit Sam Mendes, who is the planner, is the guy who sort of says, this is the sort of thing that I want to do. But when you are building shots like that as a director, you are working very closely with a cinematographer who is then charged with making all of that happen and making it look perfect and figuring out all the right lenses and where to hide all the lights. There's great commentary on the Seven commentary track where Brad Pitt and David Fincher are just talking about how, like, every day on set, they just sit around, like, and eventually they'd have to be like, Darius, stop hanging lights. Stop it. We just need to shoot a movie here. And Darius would be like, no, you have to hang more lights. And you can kind of tell that movie is overlit in the best, like, the lighting is just so richly perfect in the best possible way. And it's really, these movies are credits not just to their directors and their writers and their stars, but also to all of these incredible craftsmen who work on them.
I would say of the two skills that are least appreciated and understood by people, cinematography and editing are the one and two. Cinematography first and then editing second. I would encourage
maybe
people.
Lighting three on that list.
I mean, well, I cinematographer
kind of falls under
the DP most is the one who is in charge of hanging the lights.
Yeah.
And so they work with the grip department, but like they are primarily in charge of lighting design.
Yeah.
They work, obviously, yes, there's a production designer, and it's like, it's not just the one person doing literally everything except on very small productions, but the DP is primarily charged with having all the lights. And like you read these stories about, like, they will bring their own light kits. They're the ones who, it's not the studios who are providing stuff. They are just like, here's my collection, my van full of lights that goes with me all around the world, in which I like create beautiful images with, and that's my job. I think a lot of moviegoers forget about the role of people like that in making movies wonderful.
The first time I was on a movie set many years ago, like 15 years ago, almost now at this point, or 10 years ago now.
How old are you, Sonny? Ancient.
I remember being struck by the fact that the director was kind of like standing around and looking at things and making sure everything was more or less set up right, while the cinematographer was the guy running around, like, measuring distances and focal lengths and, like, being like, okay, we're going to push here on this track and then we're gonna get things
done.
That's
like, lighting
meter.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Okay, that is it for this. Next week's assigned viewing will be Valley of the Dolls, in preparation for a belated discussion of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. But before we go, I'd like to read a review off of our Apple Podcast page. My favorite review this week is titled "Sunny is Always Right" by Brendan175. I will assume this is also Peter and Alyssa's favorite review, and we can move on. Please go to rebellermedia.com, sign up for a membership if you don't sign
Sunny,
up.
Sunny, I left that review.
We don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple like Brendan did. And I will read the best for the next few weeks. I find that people like having their reviews read on the podcast. Get some recognition from, you know, the greats like us and
woohoo!
All the others. But we do need those reviews, people, seriously. If you review us, we do better. The algorithm picks us up and we get more filthy lucre. That's what I'm looking for, is the filthy lucre.
We review movies. You review us.
Exactly.
Reviewing movies.
Exactly. If you didn't love the show, complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.